You're listening to Breadbox Media. Find out more at breadboxmedia.com.
Welcome to News Out of the Box Weekend Edition on Breadbox Media. I'm Joe Lerza.
And I'm Kelly Sergenis. President Trump's demand for a new plan to defeat the Islamic State has triggered a flurry of behind-the-scenes activity at the Pentagon and State Department, where officials are poised to propose a dramatic increase in weapons for Kurdish fighters in Syria, significantly more U.S. airstrikes against the jihadi group, and an expansion of American Special Forces commandos operating on the ground.
Those moves, along with studying how to coordinate U.S. airstrikes with Russian forces backing Syrian President Bashar Assad, will make up the bulk of what gets presented to the White House in response to the executive order that Mr. Trump signed Friday, mandating a new plan within 30 days to defeat the terror group, also known as ISIS, officials say. One official directly involved in the planning told the Washington Times that the proposals won't start from scratch, but rather greenlight and dramatically accelerate controversial aspects of a strategy already set in motion by the Obama administration, with the most difficult piece being the movement of more and heavier arms to the ethnic Kurdish forces without outraging NATO ally Turkey. The main sticking point has been Ankara, said the official, who spoke on condition of anonymity in reference to Ankara's anger over U.S. support for a Kurdish militia in Syria that the Turks say is a terrorist organization linked to violent Turkish-Kurdish separatists.
We've been working with the Turks on this, the official said, adding that at some point we will have to make a decision. Other officials said a proposal for more U.S. special forces deployed inside Syria will expand the mission to train and possibly fight alongside the Kurdish People's Protection Unit, or YPG, and other militias in the campaign to capture Islamic State's de facto capital of Raqqa.
The White House reveled Friday in the first jobs report of the new administration that showed the U.S. economy adding 227,000 jobs in January, saying President Trump had already taken steps to turn the economy around. To be fair, though, many observers are saying that the majority of January was on President Obama's watch.
Today's report reflects the consumer confidence that the Trump presidency has inspired, said White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer, noting recent polls showing stronger consumer confidence. Mr. Spicer said he would not parse how much of the job gains were attributed to Mr. Trump and how much to former President Obama, since the report covered the transition month. But he said Mr. Trump's effects on the economy began before he took office. President Trump campaigned on how to make America work again. Even before he took office, the markets knew he would deliver on that promise, he said.
He also backed away from Mr. Trump's criticism during the campaign that the way the Labor Department calculates employment levels underestimates the jobless rate. The strong hiring surpassed expectations, while the jobless rate rose from 4.7% to 4.8%. as 76,000 more workers entered the workforce to look for jobs.
The Trump administration announced Friday that the Pentagon has reached a tentative deal with Lockheed Martin for the purchase of 90 F-35 jets at the lowest price in the program's history, saving the government millions, officials said. Trump, as president-elect, made headlines in December when he tweeted that the costs for the F-35 program were out of control.
This led to meetings and negotiations with the defense mega-contractor, apparently culminating in Friday's nearly $9 billion agreement. Lieutenant General Chris Bogdan, F-35 program executive officer, called the contract a good and fair deal for taxpayers. "We continue to work with industry to drive costs out of the program," he said in a statement. Lockheed Martin, in a statement, acknowledged Trump's involvement spurred them to drive down the cost. President Trump's personal involvement in the F-35 program accelerated the negotiations and sharpened our focus on driving down the price. The agreement was reached in a matter of weeks and represents significant savings over previous contracts. This is a good deal for the American taxpayer, our country, our company, and our suppliers, the statement said. The Pentagon announced the deal would bring the cost per jet for the F-35A below $100 million for the first time to $95 million, marking a 7.3% drop in price from the last order. Officials estimated, based on the per-plane price of the most recent F-35 order, the new agreement represents a $728 million reduction. White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer declared it another big win that the president has delivered on for U.S. taxpayers.
Reuters, which first reported on the deal, noted that the price per jet has been steadily declining for years as production ramps up, and that defense analysts have said the discount was in line with what had been cited by Lockheed and Pentagon officials for months. The contract would order up 55 jets for the U.S. Air Force, Navy, and Marine Corps, and the rest for a range of U.S. allies. Deliveries would begin in early 2018. The Defense Department said the F-35 program supports more than 1,300 suppliers in 45 states, directly and indirectly employing over 146,000 workers.
A federal judge in Seattle on Friday dealt a blow to President Trump's executive order on travel and refugees, ordering a nationwide halt of enforcement of the controversial order. The temporary restraining order by U.S. District Judge James Robart blocks the federal government from enforcing Mr. Trump's travel plan as a lawsuit brought by the Washington State Attorney General progresses through the court system.
That relief is significant, to put it mildly, Washington State Attorney General Bob Ferguson said Friday after the restraining order was issued. Mr. Trump's executive order, signed on January 27, indefinitely halted the resettlement of Syrian refugees in the U.S., blocked other refugees for 120 days, and temporarily barred all citizens of seven Muslim-majority countries: Iran, Iraq, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, and Yemen, from traveling to the U.S. 3 days later, the Washington Attorney General was the first to file a lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of the order and argued that the order hurt Washington residents and businesses and undercut the state's efforts to make itself welcoming to immigrants and refugees.
Mr. Ferguson said he expected federal officials would comply with the order, meaning that Customs and Border Protection could no longer enforce the travel restrictions.
One of the main reasons the Pilgrims first came to America was to avoid religious persecution by the British. If you've been paying attention over the past several years, you've noticed freedom of religion under attack in the name of political correctness. Out of the blue come groups like Freedom From Religion Foundation, the anti-religion wing of the ACLU, and on and on. According to a progressive website, The Nation, the president is circulating a draft of an executive order on religious liberty that will bring civil rights protections for Christians into the 21st century. Its stated purpose is to guide the executive branch in formulating and implementing policies with implications for the religious freedom of persons and organizations in America.
OneNewsNow.com reports that Christian organizations include even closely held for-profit corporations operated for a religious purpose, even if its purpose is not exclusively religious. It is a perfectly appropriate executive order because it is a directive from the head of the executive branch, the president, to everybody who works for him and under him. Here, President Trump says, is how the executive branch is going to do business under my leadership. He's not presuming to tell Congress or the Supreme Court or the states how to do their jobs. He's saying only that this is how we're going to get the job done in this separate but equal branch of government. The order states clearly and unambiguously that the United States Constitution enshrines and protects the fundamental natural right to religious liberty. It adds the following as a clear statement of Trump administration policy. This constitutional protection ensures that Americans and their religious organizations organizations will not be coerced by the federal government into participating in activities that violate their consciences and will remain free to express their viewpoints without suffering adverse treatment from the federal government.
It shall be the policy of this administration to protect religious freedom, it says. One News Now says that what must not be missed here is that the Department of Justice and the Attorney General are part of the executive branch. From this point forward, the Attorney General of the United States will be on the side of those who seek to exercise religious liberty rather than be against them. The Attorney General will now be the advocate of Christian students in schools and bakers and photographers and florists and businesses, and no longer their adversary.
The Department of Justice will be defending Christians in court rather than attacking them. This directive properly treats the free exercise of religion as a right every American possesses, not just on Sunday mornings between 11 a.m. and noon, but 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It protects not just freedom of belief or even freedom of worship, but the freedom to actually exercise one's faith in the marketplace and the public square every minute of every day without the interference of the federal government, just as the founders intended. Religious freedom is not confined to religious organizations or limited to religious exercise that takes place in houses of worship or the home. It is guaranteed to persons of all faiths and extends to all activities of life.
Christians will no longer be required to check their religious convictions at the door of their homes when they head out to the open door of their business. They will be able to run their organizations in accordance with biblical values. They will not be punished because they operate with the conviction that life begins at conception, that marriage is the union of one man and one woman, and that there are two and only two genders. The upcoming executive order contains a lot more meat that we'll tell you about in our next segment. And that wraps up this segment of News Out of the Box Weekend Edition on Breadbox Media. We'll be back after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Welcome back to Breadbox Media's News Out of the Box Weekend Edition. I'm Joe Lerza.
And I'm Kelly Serginis. Continuing now with our story on the upcoming Religious Liberty Executive Order about to be presented by President Trump in the coming days. The federal government shall not discriminate against Christian agencies that provide federally funded child welfare services, including promoting or providing adoption, foster, or family support services for children. They will now be free to follow scriptural standards and place children exclusively in homes with a mother and a father without fear of punishment from the federal government.
Christian-run businesses and organizations involved in employing others will, for example, be able to take biblical principles of human sexuality into consideration in their personnel policies without fear that the federal government will sue them out of business. The Supreme Court's Hobby Lobby ruling last year says this. Additionally, the IRS will be forbidden to withhold tax-exempt status from any organization which speaks on moral or political issues from a religious perspective. These issues explicitly include advocating for marriage as the union of one man and one woman, promoting that view that sexual relations are properly reserved for such a marriage, promoting the view that there are just two genders, male and female, which are matters of immutable biological sex determined at or before birth, and promoting the view that human life begins at conception.
In other words, no longer will the federal government punish those who advocate for natural marriage or for abstinence outside of marriage, or punish those who argue against the view that people are born that way. Christian organizations cannot be kicked off government-sponsored fundraising campaigns for speaking or acting in accordance with their religious beliefs. In other words, the federal government will not kick groups like American Family Association off its donation sites, as the state of Connecticut did. There's news every day of Christians who have been fired from government positions because of things they did or said outside the workplace, on Facebook, or, for example, as part-time pastors. Under Trump, that comes to a dead stop at the federal level. No agency will be allowed to punish a federal employee for advocating for their values while outside of the scope of their employment.
What a Christian does and says on his own time will henceforth be none of the government's business. And Christians won't be gagged even at work, say during breaks in the cafeteria and on site before or after work. Agencies will be directed to reasonably accommodate religious speech and action even within the course of their employment. No one will be prohibited from receiving government grants or contracts because their business is guided by Christian principles. Federal agencies will accommodate the religion of federal employees and will not substantially burden their religious exercise. Christian employees of federal agencies will no longer need to fear harassment and punishment for bringing their faith to work with them. Individuals who buy insurance on the exchanges must be allowed to purchase a policy that does not provide coverage for abortion and does not subsidize plans which do.
It should be noted that this order isn't about forcing anything on anyone. Any employer who doesn't want to run his business according to a Christian principle doesn't have to. But those employers who do will have a friend in this administration. The plain wording of this executive order is that it supersedes any and all executive orders that preceded it. The provisions of this order shall prevail in cases of conflict with any existing executive order and with any future executive order. In other words, if there is a conflict between this executive order on religious liberty and previous orders, religious liberty will win every time. It should be noted that this is only a draft version and has not yet been signed by the president and formally issued. Mr. Trump campaigned aggressively on the promise that if elected, he would protect religious liberty.
HIV could be eliminated using a novel combination of drugs, claims a research team on the brink of an unprecedented experiment. Scientists at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland's medical school have been granted $2.5 million to try pairing two never-before-combined AIDS treatments in a human clinical trial.
The properties, a natural protein that kills disease and a lab-made antibody, have been separately used in HIV-suppressing drugs for years. Our current lineup of medication is highly effective. Roughly 30% of America's 1.2 million people with HIV have reached an undetectable viral load, meaning treatment has suppressed the virus to the point that it is untransmittable. But lead researcher Dr. Michael Lederman believes a combination of these two properties could produce more of a wallop in tandem than when administered individually. Administered alone, both IL-2 and certain monoclonal antibodies can reduce, but not necessarily eliminate, the presence of HIV in the body, said Dr. Lederman. Our study will go to the next step and use them together. IL-2 is approved by the Food and Drug Administration for treating certain cancers. It activates killer cells and also activates HIV from latency, a positive development since the activated cells die when expressing virus. Monoclonal antibodies that neutralize HIV are cloned protein antibodies that bind to the surface of HIV and keep it from infecting the body's immune cells. They can also help killer cells attack HIV-infected cells that have been activated from latency to express virus. The study is set to include 16 patients and begin in the second half of 2017. In the 64-week study, patients in one treatment group will receive IL-2, and those in a second treatment group will receive IL-2 plus a monoclonal antibody that neutralizes HIV.
Study participants will be monitored for safety and tolerance by staff members. The team's primary aim is to see if the new combined treatment can reduce latent HIV reservoirs, cells infected with HIV but not actively producing HIV. Reservoirs, which are difficult to measure, are present even in cases of treated HIV infection, where there are no detectable levels of HIV in the blood. Although not active, the reservoirs are evidence that the infection is not cured, since they can be reactivated by any of a number of reasons. The hope is that the size of the HIV reservoir will decrease in both groups, and that the antibody will make the IL-2 treatment more potent. A previous retrospective study suggested that IL-2 treatment could decrease the size of latent HIV reservoirs. We think it's important to try to confirm those findings in a prospective trial, and just as important, see if the addition of a monoclonal antibody enhances the activity of IL-2, said Dr. Lederman. He and his study colleagues are in discussions with the National Institutes of Health's Vaccine Research Center to determine which monoclonal antibody to use among several the center has developed to prevent or treat HIV infection.
Is the November presidential election causing a rift in your family? A new Rasmussen poll shows that a lot of Americans have hard feelings after last November's presidential election. The Rasmussen National Telephone and Online Survey finds that 40% of likely U.S. voters think the election has negatively affected their personal relationship with a friend or family member.
That's a jump from the 26% who said just days before the election that the presidential race itself had already hurt their relationship with a friend or family member. Contrary to the media and most pollsters who felt Hillary Clinton was a shoo-in for the presidency, Donald Trump was the surprise winner. 54% of voters who strongly disapprove of the job President Trump is doing say the election has hurt a personal relationship. Just 35% of those who strongly approve of Trump's job performance agree. 77% of all voters now think Americans today are less tolerant of each other's political opinions than they were in the past. That's up from 70% in November. Voters were last this pessimistic just weeks before the 2012 presidential election. Only 11% think Americans are more tolerant of each other's views than in the past, while 10% think the level of tolerance is about the same. The survey of 1,000 likely voters was conducted on January 31st through February 1st. Of this year by Rasmussen Reports. The margin of sampling error is plus or minus 3 percentage points with a 95% level of confidence.
50% of voters believe America is a more divided nation after the 8 years of the Obama presidency. Just prior to the presidential election, only 13% said the United States will be a more unified nation in a year's time, regardless of who wins. 52% expected the country to be more divided instead. Women and younger voters are more likely than men, and those 40 and over to say a personal relationship has suffered because of the election. But older voters agree with women that there is less political tolerance in America today. Majorities across all political parties think Americans are less tolerant of others' political views, but Republicans at 69% believe so less strongly than Democrats and voters not affiliated with either major party.
47% of Democrats say the election has hurt a personal relationship, compared to 42% of Republicans and 30% of unaffiliateds. Interestingly, voters who think Americans are more tolerant of the political views of others these days are the most likely to say the election has negatively affected a personal relationship. In November, 26% of all voters said the 2016 presidential election was causing more stress in their family. But just 21% of Americans intended to avoid politics completely during the post-election holiday family gatherings. Shortly after the election, voters were closely divided over whether the street protests against Trump's election were the product of genuine concern or just being staged by troublemakers.
But most agreed the protests wouldn't achieve anything good. Most voters wanted Democrats to work with Trump once he was in the White House, but Democrats strongly disagreed. Still, voters were more hopeful about the parties cooperating than they'd been since President Obama's inauguration in 2009. 2009. While Democrats plot to delay or stop Trump's cabinet choices and his first nominee to the U.S. Supreme Court, voters strongly believe all of his selections deserve a final vote by the full Senate. A majority of voters, including half of Democrats, don't think Democrats in Congress will be able to halt the new president's agenda. And that wraps up this segment of News Out of the Box Weekend Edition on Breadbox Media. We'll be back after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Welcome back to News Out of the Box Weekend Edition on Breadbox Media. I'm Joe Lerzo.
And I'm Kelly Sergenis. The International Baccalaureate is an organization of 4,000 schools worldwide who teach students to think independently, become more culturally aware, and are able to engage with people in an increasingly globalized and rapidly changing world. IB programs aim to do more than other curricula by developing inquiring, knowledgeable, and caring young people who help to create a better and more peaceful world through intercultural understanding and respect. In my other life, my non-radio life, I am an associate principal in an IB middle school. In an effort to raise citizens prepared to enter an interdependent world, we regularly orchestrate projects that raise cultural awareness. We partner with Haitian schools and collect books for their library. We raise money to build wells in Africa. We go without shoes once a year to gain perspective on poverty. We educate on MS and prostate cancer and other health-related issues. The list goes on and on. This week, we participated in World Hijab Day. A hijab is a veil traditionally worn by Muslim women that covers the head and chest. World Hijab Day occurs February 1st every year. It was started in 2013 by Muslim women seeking to educate the non-Muslim world that despite stereotypes, to many Muslim women, the hijab is not a symbol of an oppressive regime, but a religious article of clothing that signifies freedom and independence. In 2016, hate crimes against Muslim Americans tripled. I am a Catholic who participated in World Hijab Day to educate students about perspective and stand in solidarity with the independent and intelligent women I've been blessed to know and teach over the years. It was merely coincidental that this established day fell during the week of the immigration ban. Our participation was in no way a political statement, nor did I intend even to engage in a social experiment. But the few hours I spent in hijab opened my eyes to a world that I've known existed, but I've never experienced. We invited the mothers of our Muslim students to help us properly wrap our scarves. They were gracious and grateful. I soon learned why. Within minutes of covering my head, I was called a terrorist. I was called an infidel. I was asked why I let them staple that thing to my head. These words, inside my own world, by my own people, with all sincerity. The halls I walk every day, greeted by love and hugs and smiles and high fives, were darker. They were menacing. I made a point to venture out. I ran errands to other schools where I wasn't known. I went through a drive-thru in the evening. Without doubt, kind words and extraordinary gentleness were offered to me, too, throughout the day. But those first words were so quick, so matter-of-fact, and so powerful, they pierced me. Those of us who participated gathered at the end of the day to reflect on the experience. There were about 13 of us. My story was echoed over and over again. We were struck by the reality that our experience at our own school was starkly different than the experience of some of our students and their parents, our substitute teachers, all because of a piece of cloth. Saddened and hurting, we went home. I picked up my own children, ages 2, 4, and 6, that evening, still in hijab, and was stunned that none of them noticed. They didn't say a word or ask any questions or even have a funny look on their face when they saw me. At some point, stereotypes are learned. Fear and hatred is not innate. That evening, I took the hijab off and moved on, thinking that my experience was over. But what I wasn't prepared for was the anger that was yet to come on social media. People who didn't speak up during the day took to the computer, insisting that the group of us who participated were victimizing terrorists and supporting oppression, and we were too liberal to listen to reason. We sought to see the world from another's shoes, and we were publicly flogged for it. And the thing is, this was just 8 hours of my life. There are people, American citizens, for whom this is reality all day, every day, in the land of the free. Terrorism and human rights violations across the globe must be stopped, but not by hatred, not by fear. We cannot justify generalizations of mass groups of people based on the actions of the extreme. Most of all, we who walk through the world each day unaffected, we cannot pretend that privilege doesn't exist, that the fear others experience is imagined or exaggerated, or that our personal experience defines the whole of human experience. We are called by Christ to do better, to be better, to love better.
Diabetes could be an early sign of pancreatic cancer, a new research study suggests. A presentation to the European Cancer Congress in Amsterdam reports that 50% of people in two sample groups who had been diagnosed with pancreatic cancer had been diagnosed with type 2 diabetes in the previous year and been given their first medication to control it. Fewer than 5 out of 100 people can expect to be alive 5 years after being diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. Survival rates are poor because the cancer doesn't usually cause any symptoms until late in the disease.
The American Cancer Society estimates more than 53,000 people will be diagnosed with pancreatic cancer in 2017. Although it has been known for some time that there is an association between type 2 diabetes and pancreatic cancer, the relationship between the two conditions is complex. Alex Coughlin from the International Prevention Research Institute in Lyon, France, told the conference, "The pancreas contains cells that make insulin. Type 2 diabetes happens when these cells are unable to make enough insulin, or the insulin doesn't work properly." The study involved 368,377 people with type 2 diabetes in Belgium and 456,311 in Italy. Among those patients over a five-year period, there were 885 and 1,872 cases of pancreatic cancer diagnosed, respectively. The researchers found that patients had a 3.5 times higher risk of being diagnosed with pancreatic cancer compared to those on other non-insulin, non-incretin diabetes treatments in the first 3 months after their first prescription for a class of diabetes medication known as incretins. The risks decreased with time. Those are hormones that stimulate the pancreas to produce more insulin. Among patients who already had type 2 diabetes, the need to switch to injecting insulin because their condition got worse was associated with a 7 times higher risk of being diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. Doctors and their diabetic patients should be aware that the onset of diabetes or a rapidly deteriorating diabetes could be the first sign of hidden pancreatic cancer, and steps should be taken to investigate it, Coughlin said.
The association between pancreatic cancer and type 2 diabetes has been an area of interest to researchers for several years. So it's great to see studies generating new and potentially very valuable information which could alert clinicians to the need for future investigation in certain patients, said Maggie Blanks, chief executive of the Pancreatic Cancer Research Fund, in a statement. "We now need the work developing early diagnostics tests to catch up so that we can make use of this information as soon as possible. There are global efforts investigating biomarkers for pancreatic cancer in blood or saliva that may have diagnostic potential, and the early research that PCRF has funded, which identified biomarkers in urine, is progressing towards a clinical trial. We may well be on the cusp of a significant improvement in both identifying those at higher risk and being able to diagnose quickly so that appropriate treatment can start as soon as possible."
Attendance at movie theaters is down, especially in major U.S. cities. Now many theaters are looking to alcohol sales to boost lagging attendance. More theater chains are installing bars to pad profits as states relax liquor laws.
For decades, local and state laws prevented movie chains from offering alcoholic beverages in regular auditoriums. Only dine-in theaters could offer booze by securing a restaurant liquor license, while some high-end cinemas, including the Landmark and Arclight in L.A., offered beer and wine in designated 21 and over auditoriums. During the past 2 years, 32 states have relaxed their laws, allowing theaters to serve alcohol in any auditorium. Concessions, long the biggest profit center for movie houses, are becoming more important as attendance numbers remain flat or decline. In 2015, AMC's food and beverage revenue hit about $910 million, a 4% uptick from $647 million in 2010.
Those 2015 revenue numbers are even sweeter considering the cost of concessions was just $129 million. Regal also reported increased food and beverage revenue of about $910,000 in 2015 compared with $724,000 in 2010.
When you're president of the United States, you operate in a media fishbowl. That's every president, Democrat or Republican. The media follows you around watching your every move. To put it mildly, it's tough to keep things secret.
But President Trump pulled off keeping his Supreme Court nominee secret until a few minutes after 8 o'clock Tuesday night when he made the announcement in front of a full room of legislators and, yes, the media that follows him around. Less than 48 hours before Neil Gorsuch was introduced as President Donald Trump's Supreme Court nominee, he was traveling in secret down Colorado backroads to a military aircraft as part of a White House operation to keep his selection under wraps. Gorsuch, a 49-year-old federal appeals court judge in Denver, was informed that he was Trump's choice in a Monday phone call from the president. White House spokesman Sean Spicer said, describing the measures employed to preserve secrecy, shortly after the call, Gorsuch, who lives near Boulder, Colorado, went to a neighbor's house and waited for the White House staff to arrive.
Since he was already widely reported as a frontrunner for the job, White House staffers drove back roads to make sure they wouldn't be spotted with him. They ferried him aboard a military jet from Colorado to Washington, where he stayed with a friend rather than at a hotel to avoid being noticed. While the Trump White House has seen its inner battles aired in the media during its first days in office, administration officials showed Tuesday that they can keep a secret when they want to. White House officials had strongly signaled to lawmakers that Gorsuch was a contender, but the administration wanted Trump's pick to come out on his terms in front of a live primetime television audience, and they succeeded. That wraps up this segment of News Out of the Box Weekend Edition on Breadbox Media. We'll be right back.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Welcome back to News Out of the Box Weekend Edition on Breadbox Media. I'm Joe Lerza.
And I'm Kelly Sergenis. The senator in charge of the confirmation process for President Trump's Supreme Court nominee says he wants to have Judge Neil Gorsuch on the high court by Easter, laying out a speedy schedule that's likely to meet resistance from Democrats.
Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Charles Grassley told Roll Call that he's optimistic about working with Senator Dianne Feinstein, the ranking Democrat on the committee, on Judge Gorsuch's confirmation over the next 6 weeks. Every conversation that I've had with her, now that she's ranking member, has been not only friendly, but has been productive. And these little head-to-heads that you see us having when the committee's actually functioning work things out right then, Mr. Grassley told the paper. I hope she would tell you that I have accommodated her. According to Roll Call, Ms. Feinstein is scheduled to meet with Judge Gorsuch on Monday, as a Supreme Court nominee has been making rounds at the Capitol, meeting with senators following his formal nomination on Tuesday.
Republicans and Democrats alike praise the appellate judge for his legal credentials, but liberal advocacy groups are demanding Democrats throw up roadblocks, saying the judge would threaten their ideological causes if he is allowed to take the seat left vacant by the death of Justice Antonin Scalia. Democratic leaders have already said they will filibuster the nomination, leaving Republicans to face the decision about whether or not to change the Senate rule that requires 60 votes to confirm a Supreme Court nominee, the so-called nuclear option.
In a meeting Tuesday with drug company executives, President Donald Trump said he would cut their taxes and regulations in order to lower drug prices and create jobs. Attendees included executives from Celgene, Merck, Johnson & Johnson, and Amgen, the Associated Press reported.
It can take as long as 15 years and millions of dollars to get a new drug approved in the U.S., according to Trump. He said the current 9,000 pages of regulations should be slashed to 100. Also, Trump said patients with terminal illnesses should be allowed to try treatments that are not fully approved, the AP reported. Trump's tone at the meeting was far different than his first press conference as president, when he said drug companies had been getting away with murder because the federal government did not make them compete for its business.
After the meeting, Merck CEO Kenneth Frazier told reporters that the session was very constructive and that Trump was very much focused on finding ways to give patients more choices, the AP reported. Trump said he will soon identify his pick to head the FDA.
When Neil Gorsuch was introduced as President Trump's nominee for the Supreme Court at the White House before a big primetime television audience on Tuesday night, there was one man in Kentucky who knew all about the political pressure cooker the Colorado judge was about to enter. Chief Justice John Roberts was watching the made-for-television reveal in the private office of the head coach of the University of Kentucky men's basketball team, John Calipari, and perked up when he saw Trump take the stroll down a red carpet to a waiting podium in the East Room. He said, "That's a long distance," Calipari recounted in a telephone interview. He walked it. Indeed, Roberts took a dramatic stroll down that red carpet to the East Room when then-President George W. Bush at his side in March of 2005 for his own nomination.
In the case of Gorsuch, the television-savvy Trump took the walk to the podium alone, and then a few minutes later had Gorsuch and his wife Marie Louise emerge from a side door to reveal the president's pick, with maximum surprise for the audience in the East Room and watching at home. Nonetheless, various news reports had suggested earlier on Tuesday that Gorsuch was the likely choice, and Roberts would not let on to Calipari whether he had been tipped off about the pick or was happy about it. He said, "I'm not going to show any emotion now," recounted Calipari. "I have a feeling they probably gave him a heads up. He was not like, wow, nothing." Roberts was at Kentucky's Tuesday night basketball matchup with the University of Georgia at the invitation of James Duff, director of the Administrative Office of the U.S. Courts, who played for Kentucky himself. On Wednesday, Roberts delivered a speech on campus and then took questions from Duff. The Chief Justice had sent word he would like to meet with Calipari before the 9 p.m. game, though the meeting was cutting it close for the coach because Roberts did not arrive until a few minutes before 8 p.m. when he needed to be prepping for the matchup.
But Calipari, well known for being a genial social networker, was ready to make adjustments if need be to meet one of nine Supreme Court justices. "I will delay the game if I have to in order to meet him," Calipari said with a laugh. The two men watched Trump speak and then listened to a couple minutes of Gorsuch's remarks before an aide came in to say Calipari had to get going. Roberts did not want to be singled out by the announcer at the game, and he took a seat in the fourth row rather than sitting, well, courtside. "Being in his company, I can tell he is a kind, humble kind of person," said Calipari, who noted that after a terrible start in which Kentucky was losing 19-5, his team recovered to win an overtime thriller 90-81. "He saw a heck of a game," said Calipari, who will now be returned the favor of getting a heck of an experience in Washington. "He invited me to the Supreme Court," said the backslapping Calipari, who sounded like he could not wait to follow up. "You know me, I'll be there."
An elderly Texas woman and her son jumped into a bathtub to avoid injury or death in a deadly tornado last week. The tornado picked up the bathtub they were hiding in, spun it in the air, and put them back down in the woods without injury. 75-year-old Charlsetta Williams was watching television with her son on Saturday when the twister approached her home. They raced to the bathroom and hid under a blanket in the tub for shelter, a choice that proved to be wise. The tornado continued in a northeast direction, crossing CR 3300, at which point it removed the roof of a home, wrote the National Weather Service. A woman inside took shelter in a bathtub, and the tornado lifted the tub out of the home and deposited it in the woods with the woman still in the tub, but the woman was not injured. Williams says she feels blessed to be alive. I wasn't looking. I was under that quilt, Williams told KSLA. She said she'd rather not ride through another one.
The Super Bowl means a lot to professional football players, but it also means a great deal to retailers. According to a survey commissioned by the National Retail Federation, American consumers will spend an average of $75 each on the Super Bowl. That comes out to a total of $14.1 billion. NRF spokeswoman Anna Serafin Smith says the obvious expenditures are for food and beverages that people tend to serve at their parties or the parties they're going to. But one thing that folks tend to forget is that this is the perfect time of year for people to buy televisions and upgrade their TVs to host parties and have their friends over. Team apparel is another big area for Super Bowl spending. So whether it's hat or coats or jerseys, Smith says, those are big things that folks tend to purchase when it comes to the Super Bowl.
There was a rare natural sight that a lot of people saw in parts of Wyoming County, Pennsylvania this week called light pillars. One woman's photo of them quickly went viral on Facebook. She explained what she saw in Wyoming County and why she calls it a spiritual experience. Brittany Smarkuski saw it shining in the sky when she arrived home in Nicholson Monday night.
It was so strange, said Smarkuski. She wasn't alone. Additional photos were sent from the Chapman Lake area of Lackawanna County. Numerous people tell us they saw towers of light throughout the sky. They were in the entire night sky, and it was pitch dark out. And it was amazing how the camera picked up all the color and all the lights, said Smarkuski. They are called light pillars, and they are rare, requiring the perfect conditions in the atmosphere to capture light sources from below reflecting off like ice crystals.
It was a very cold, dry night that night, and in the atmosphere, there are little plates of ice. As they tumble through the atmosphere, they reflect light when the plates are perfectly aligned, so you're seeing the reflection from a light source, explained WNEP meteorologist Joe Snedeker.
Retired Air Force Master Sergeant Mark Evans dedicates his life to sending Chicago deep dish pizzas to soldiers deployed in the Middle East. Evans, who is based in the Chicago suburbs, is the force behind the nonprofit Pizzas for Patriots, now in its ninth year. The group offers help to service members, veterans, and first responders by providing America's favorite food while they're away from home. There's no better feeling than paying it forward, Evans told Fox News. Evans explains that the idea started on July 4th, 8 years ago. He was eating pizza with his son while watching the news.
My son looked at the soldiers in Iraq on TV and asked me what they were eating. I told him meals ready to eat, or MREs, not pizza, Evans recalled. He asked me if I could send them some pizzas. Evans, who made some important friends from his years in the military, decided to reach out to General David Petraeus. In an email, Evans explained to Petraeus that he wanted to send 2,000 pizzas to Iraq. From there, a cheesy partnership was born. Evans has been sending pizzas to the troops every Independence Day and Super Bowl Sunday since. The pies are shipped half-baked, and the troops come up with creative ways to reheat the food, some even using the heat from Humvee engines. Since 2008, Evans says almost 170,000 pizzas have been shipped across the Atlantic. I just like to see smiles on soldiers' faces, and the stories I hear are incredible, he says. This year, 800 more Pizzeria Uno pies are headed to Bagram Air Force Base in Afghanistan for Sunday's big matchup between the New England Patriots and the Atlanta Falcons. Thanks to donations that Evans raises through the year, the pizzas are flown to the troops via private helicopters.
I raise money. I go on TV and I beg for money. My wife calls me the show dog or the talker, Evans says. Evans also works at AT&T, which sponsors his nonprofit. Additionally, the group provides pizzas to veterans' hospitals around the country. Some people do incredible things. Look at Trump. Look at Neil Armstrong. No one thought that they could do what they were going to do, Evans says. He added, we're very blessed.
And that wraps up News Out of the Box Weekend Edition on Breadbox Media. For Kelly Sergenis, I'm Joe Lerza, reminding you to always think out of the box.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.